Hello, this is Yu Vopal.
Hey, this is Sid Lowe.
Welcome to Big Lens Fast Shutter, where we demystify the world of sports photography.
Here at News, both Ryu and I will tell you about our best and worst shoot of the previous month, and we talk about ourselves because we like to. So, Ryu, this month, what was your best shoot and worst shoot?
My best shoot and the worst shoot, probably. I went to shoot judo. There's an Asian senior championship in Abu Dhabi and UAE. Senior, not meaning like old people, but I think just people who are not 12 years old. It's a proper championship of all Asian countries. Tournament itself was interesting. For 3 days, I got to stay in a country that I've never been to. Quality was quite high, but the people who were organizing were probably the absolute worst people I've ever dealt with. But the people over there were just awful. I've actually seen, you know, two-year-old birthday parties organized better than the people who are organizing the judo tournament over there. No one wants to take responsibilities. No one wants to do what they are told to do. And it was awful. Nothing started on time and dragged on for hours on end. Can't get any food because there's nothing in the neighborhood. They won't even give us any food because it's not our food, and so on and so on and so on. Bad. I really, really, really,
so,
really,
so what
really
was so
bad
good about it?
Well, it's the fact that I got to shoot judo. That's the only good thing about it. The rest really was quite bad because you just go straight to the tournament and you come back and, you know, everything is closed. It's too hot to walk outside during the day and there's nothing, you know, good. But it's good to shoot judo. It's a bit of a break from taking, you know, football pictures and things like that. What about you?
So this month I had a great shoot. It was actually 5 days, and it was 5 days with a course in New York, nothing to do with sports, but about how to see different things in an images, sorry, in the landscape and make into your image. And the course was with a photographer called Jay Mazel, and Jay's been teaching workshops for about the last 2 years. And he's sort of the godfather of a lot of the current photographers that have become quite famous through the internet. So people like Scott Kelby, people like Joe McNally, John Paul Cabanegro, I believe, Seth Resnick. So there's a whole bunch of people that have built businesses through the internet, and their experience as photographers have all gone through and been tutored and done this workshop with Jay Mazel. There was a lot of parallels about how to, I suppose, take street photography of people interacting with each other, seeing different things in the landscape. And the similarities with sport kind of goes like this. When we shoot a game like soccer or football, it's 90 minutes, everything's self-contained in a stadium, and you watch people come into your sort of zone where you want to shoot them, and then they drift in and out and so forth. You've got action where when a single person runs with a ball, it's kind of boring. When two people interact and tackle or, you know, do something, it becomes more interesting. Guess what? It's just like that in street photography. You can basically park yourself in a corner, wait for people to come into the area, which is, you know, where you want to shoot them. And if it's just one person, it's really just about...
So wait. Is it kind of like stalking?
Exactly. So there's two types, you know, one where you're just shooting people without them knowing, and they're more like candid shots. And then there's ones where you actually approach the people and you sort of say, can I take a photo, interact with them, and so forth. Basically, everybody says yes if you ask them in the right way. And this was part of the course too, is, you know, how do you approach people? How do you engage with them? More often than not, everybody says yes. If you wait on a corner, and if you know New York City, there's a very busy corner down in the Soho area. It's a corner of Spring Street and Broadway. It's a huge, busy intersection, and you start taking photos of them. And just like a sports shoot, a single person is less interesting than two people interacting. And you start seeing different things. You start playing around with angles, looking at different positions, getting clean backgrounds. The other thing that I learned a lot of was Jay never crops after taking the shot. So everything is
take
perfect.
That. That's exactly what it should be. No, because that's what I never crop mine either.
Exactly.
Don't crop, people. Don't crop.
The least you have to crop in post, the better it's going to be. You know, that was quite foreign for a lot of people. It was really, you know, enlightening, really exciting. That was the best shoot this month. Nothing to do with sport, but it was basically a workshop with Jay Mazel. And I'll post a link up on the website. It's a pretty wild 5 days. And I'll also post a link to the images that I shot over the 5 days as well.
I think people probably want to know, Was it worth it? And was it worth the money?
Oh, for sure. I learned things, not so much about how to shoot sports better, but how to shoot the environment better. Often I'll go to a game and apart from shooting the sport, I sort of look around the stadium and say, well, how can I shoot the stadium this interesting? How do I shoot the environment? How do I get more of a sense of, I suppose, looking at the sports event more like a photojournalist than looking at a sports photographer? So if you like that kind of stuff, thoroughly recommend Jay's course.
What's the plan for May then? You got anything planned? Any big shoots?
Nothing unusual. It's pretty quiet down in Australia for sport at the moment. It's the start of the Australian Rules Football, AFL, and I'm not shooting AFL at the moment. So there's a bit of rugby. I shot the last round of the Asian Champions League last night. No international events either, so it's a bit quiet, but we'll see. I'm sure something will crop up. And you, what do you got planned this month?
Going to Barcelona this weekend to shoot the EuroLeague Basketball Final Four. And then next week I go to Levante in Valencia to shoot Levante-Barcelona. And then next day to Madrid to shoot Madrid-someone else. And then the weekend is kind of the same. I have to shoot Real Madrid and Barcelona. So Real Madrid-Barcelona twice this week.
So that's not UEFA League. No, that's not the Champions League.
No, it's for a magazine. They want me to go and shoot, so which is quite cool. But yeah, I just can't wait for the season to be over and I get to go back to Japan on the 23rd. That's it.
We Introduce is a section where we present a sports photographer or a person related to the sports photography business. And who do we have this month, Sid?
This month we have Tom.
Hello, that'll be me then.
Tom, welcome to our show. I understand that you first met Ryu online, just like I did. You were interested in helping out with this podcast, so thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It was a bit of a short notice as well. If you could tell us how you started out in photography, in particular sports photography.
Simple truth is I came to sports photography much later on, having already been a professional photographer and assistant for quite some time. When I started out in photography, like anybody else, as a keen amateur, just snapping away, I did that for a couple of years. Then when I was 15, I took work experience that my school was offering at the local newspaper in the photographic department. Overnight, my sort of life changed because I'd gone from, you know, as most amateurs do, you keep a roll of film in the camera until it runs out, to suddenly going through, you know, 10 rolls of film a day and chasing the police helicopter and doing fashion shoots. And you know, this is back in the days when you actually shot and devved and printed your own black and white film and you handed prints to the news desk. I mean, you know, real old school stuff back in the early 90s. And of course, at 15, that was extremely exciting. I was one of those very lucky people who at that early age knew what they wanted to do and just stuck at it. Went off to college, did more work experience down at London, and from then built a career after that. I started out as an assistant, as is normal, and built up the contacts I'd got assisting and started shooting for myself in 2001. Most of the sports stuff has come about through simple nepotism, through working for person X and then their mate, person Y, calls and asks if they've got somebody available to shoot something the next day and I'm available. And before you know it, probably been about 7 or 8 years now, I've done lots and lots of sports stuff. And it tends to be for that sort of reason rather than any particular design on my part.
It's wonderful to see so many sports people being captured for, obviously, the covers for magazines and, you know, having them in action. And that's an aspect of sports photography that Ryu and I aren't really involved in. How do you come up with staging the scenarios and playing the shots? Most of them are sort of them in action with off-camera flash.
If you look at the website, some of the off-camera flash stuff isn't staged at all. There's probably a half dozen pictures on there that are actually real live events, like cross-country races and things, which are shot for real. You know, those are runners actually running or riding on the race. They're still lit and they're still given the same production values. And that's because I've sort of refined the whole thing of carrying off-camera flashes and flash guns, you know, which has obviously become very popular in recent years with Strobis and all the rest, to the point where I can put a rucksack on my back on my bike or even run and actually get round these courses. And then all you need to do is, if you know enough about the course and where people are going, you find bottlenecks where people are going to be so you can channel them basically into a studio you've just made. Because obviously in the studio, you tend to keep people within a fairly confined area so the lighting works. The other stuff where it's actually staged outright, obviously some of the ideas will be mine, but a lot of the time the ideas come from the client, be they a magazine or a PR company or a commercial company, because obviously I'm being employed to carry out their brief.
So I was kind of wondering if you do take any golf, for instance?
I have been to many a European tour event, but I don't go to photograph the action. Okay. That's not what I'm commissioned to do. I'm commissioned, if I'm there for the day, which is only maybe once or twice a year, I will be there because we will have some time with Lee Westwood, with Ian Poulter, with whomever.
Okay.
Or I might be sent there to do a reportage feature, you know, behind the scenes with Sky News at the Irish Open or something. In terms of actual live events that I shoot, I do tend to shoot triathlons quite a lot. I've done a lot of running events. I was at the marathon last weekend, for example, for the fourth year running at the London Marathon, which is obviously always quite hard work. I've never followed football, for one thing, so I have no personal interest in football stuff. I do like rugby, but I don't tend to be on the touchline. The case is that I've been sent to lots of things live, including some very obscure sports. Like, I photographed something called Octopush, which is underwater hockey. And I photographed cage fighting, and I photographed, you know, no end of very obscure things. But that's because a magazine has sent me to go and do a story about that, rather than I have been following the jiu-jitsu circuit or the cage fighting circuit. It tends to be led by whoever's commissioning me.
Can you just tell us a bit more about triathlon? Because it's an all-day event.
Depends on the distance, but yes, it can be an all-day event.
Do you actually go and swim with them, or do you actually shoot from a platform when you're doing swimming, and then the running and the bikes? Yeah. And
you highlighted swimming, and swimming is by far and away the hardest thing to photograph. I've only twice been able to get out on the water because it's just incredibly complicated dealing with the marshals and people who are organising the race. And of course, as anybody can imagine, most swim shots taken from the bank are of a head or an arm sticking out the water, and that's pretty much all you're ever going to get. So I have managed to shoot one once with an underwater camera where the water was shallow enough that I basically waded in up to my neck and just shoved the underwater camera in triathletes' faces as they went swimming past, which they let me do at my own risk, thankfully, because it is quite risky. Otherwise, as with any sport, the secret to shooting it is doing a little bit of homework and learning how things go. I mean, right down to really basic things of understanding that they will come out of the swim in a wetsuit, they will run to transition, where they'll strip their wetsuits off, where they will jump on a bike, where they will leave, where they will cycle, where they will come in, how quickly things will last and how far some people go, right down to knowing on an Olympic distance triathlon a fast time is sort of 2 hours, 2 hours 10. So if you're sitting there on the cycle bit expecting something to have gone past and you've been there for an hour and 45 minutes, you've missed them. It often comes down to simple homework of, you know, knowing what to expect and trying to preempt things happening a little bit.
It's all in the planning, isn't it, Tom? Anticipation
and planning. I mean, when I say about photographing the races with off-camera flash, it helps to know the course as well. If you know that there's going to be a particularly good bend on the bike ride or the runners are going to go through a particularly interesting bit, well, yeah, you do everything you can to get there first.
Does any photo of a triathlon stand out in your own mind as one of your favourite shots of a triathlon?
Probably my most pleasurable one would either be from some of the off-road ones I've done, which are naturally more exciting because they include, you know, mountain biking, a real difficult trail run, or that one triathlon where I managed to photograph the swim from an underwater camera in the water, because I managed to get some very impressive shots of people launching themselves off the pontoon, but from within the water looking back, which of course just a much more exciting shot than the usual head and eyes above the water and an arm splashing past, which could be anybody anywhere. So as always, trying to get something a bit different is the answer.
On the same vein, I'd love to know how you plan shooting a marathon, because I've shot road cycling. If you miss the action, for a marathon, they only do one lap. So
they do, I think it's just the same as triathlons in the sense of it helps, obviously, that I have full passes that allow me access wherever I need to go, and I can, you know, duck under the barriers as required. It helps knowing the course. I mean, in the case of the London Marathon, obviously, I know the course, I know the city very well. Usually when I photograph the London Marathon, I am actually there for one of the key sponsors, so I'm told to be in specific places rather than me deciding this would be a good shot, that would be a good shot. Even within a certain area, it's still a case of thinking, right, well, this is a better angle. And also, inevitably, recognising the fact that, okay, I am at, say, mile 19, the race started an hour and a half ago, the front runners will be here pretty soon. You get a feel for the field in terms of, okay, we're now looking at people who are struggling, so if I want to get to the finish for the people left, I'd better get moving. Getting a sense of how the day is progressing, you know, how long people are going to take, where they're going to go. And then, of course, as always, keeping your eyes absolutely peeled for anything interesting that you suddenly spot.
Are you able to capture the start and the middle part of the race? And is there access to go around the circuit, say, in London?
Last weekend, I was in three places, both the start and the finish, and then a section in the middle. In previous years, I've done up to five different places. Obviously, you need the passes. The other thing, which I'm not too worried about people hearing this, because I'm sure the powers that be aren't listening, obviously, your access depends on how the marshals behave at events like that, because some marshals will see you in all your gear and your passes and your vests and just say, but they don't mind you going under the barriers. Other marshals, you're expected to stand in one square metre and not move, and of course, that can become difficult. So you tend to learn where are good spots to sneak through and where are good spots to just, okay, I'd better be official and correct here. I mean, for example, at the finish last weekend, I had a proper gantry vest, which allows me onto the massive gantry they built at the finish. And when I turned up at the end, one of the paratroopers who was doing security would not let me on, despite the fact I'm wearing a massive white vest which says finish line gantry from 12:15. Waited 5 minutes for somebody else to come along in the same vest. He walked in, I walked in behind him, and I was in. And it's just a case of, well, I'm clearly supposed to be here. You're just being a Jobsworth. I'm sure you've encountered them many, many times yourselves. So,
with all the running events, do you actually have to stay fit as well? Because you have to kind of go from one place to another all the time. And
that is an undeniable part of it. I shall be honest and say I have done my upper back in. You strap a 15-kilo rucksack to your back with stands sticking out the side of it, and then you go running up hills, or you sit on a bike for 20 miles up and down hills. You will get off and try and straighten up, and there'll be a cracking noise as you straighten up. I'm 34 next month, and I'm pretty fit, but I notice bits like that, as anybody would. Yeah, it helps me fit. At the end of the day, I think, like any athlete would tell you, you can only get fit for the event if you train for that event. I've often found myself struggling up some hill thinking I thought I was fitter than this, but of course I'm going for flat 10K runs at a steady pace. So if you try and strap a 15-kilo weight on your back and sprint up a hill, you'll get knackered if that's all you're fit for. So, yeah. So yes, I have occasionally done training with heavy rucksacks on and sprinted up and down hills just for the sake of it. Yeah, slightly mental.
Tom, what kind of camera equipment do you use? Are you a Nikon or a Canon shooter?
I'm a Nikon boy. I have been for nearly 3 years because 2.5 years ago, I did the first of two lecture tours, which were sponsored by Nikon and Calumet. And at the time, I happened to be using somebody else's cameras. And Nikon said, we can't have that. So the first year's lecture tour I did, I was paid in camera equipment.
Fantastic. Nice.
Exactly. I was kitted out from head to foot. I mean, obviously, from my side, part of my deal was, yes, I know you want me to use your gear, but I currently have two bodies, seven lenses, five flash guns, blah, 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 blah. If you want me to play your game, you need to replace this, which they did. So I had a completely new kit as of 2.5, 3 years ago. And I was originally using Nikon up until 2004. And there may or may not be people listening who remember that in 2004, Nikon rather carelessly made a public announcement that they were not going to go down the full frame route. And an awful lot of people, myself included, dumped Nikon almost on the spot and switched over to 5Ds, or yeah, Mark 1s in those days, and 1DSs, because it was so clear that obviously full frame was the way forward. So I was Canon for 4 years, and then when the opportunity came along, I switched back. And yes, I haven't looked back since because I love them.
Tom, I really like that shot of yours. You took the runner going up the hill and you just lit it from the left-hand side. I think in shots like that where it's clear that the flash is not on the camera because not in that angle, it just looks beautiful.
Part of it is down to, you know, the fact that I'm working for consumer magazines and that there's no real attempt to pretend like I'm reporting the news. In fact, quite the opposite. What they'd much rather see is something dramatic, something interesting.
It's a stylized version of the event.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's what they're after. It's also what my better paying clients in terms of PR agencies and commercial agencies want, because obviously if they are doing a thing for LucasAid Sport or something, they want the guy to look like he's just running out of an advert, you know, like it's absolutely, everything is perfect and stylized and perfection. So that they expect that level of control and that level of artifice. It goes with the territory slightly.
Cross country, for example, some of those almost looks like they're shot with remote cameras. Just plonk a camera, cover it up, and as they run past.
That's called getting very wet and dirty. I wish it was a remote camera sometimes. I mean, certainly some of the stuff where the guys are covered in mud, that's because I am in that mud as well. Obviously, I'll try and zoom in a little bit, but effectively, yeah. I am that close to it. I've been in some quite unpleasant places and sort of and been stuck there for quite some time now and again. So
I think it adds a dimension to sports photography that a lot of people intuitively associate, but they don't see or learn much about. It's the stylized depiction of the sport. If you think about somebody that's interested in football, I think during a week, they would probably be hit with more stylized images of their sport than the actual event. Because yes, when they open a magazine, they open a newspaper, the actual event sports is usually only the day after Saturday, Sunday paper, whenever it is. All of the other billboards, advertising, everything around that sport, you know, is the stuff that you're shooting, probably got more page impressions, if we can use that metric, that people are familiar with, than the actual sports event.
Coming to it from an amateur point of view, I think one of the things to bear in mind if you're starting out and want to shoot sports for a hobby but improve them, is if you try and move beyond the notion of you are recording what is in front of you and capturing action, to moving it slightly into your own domain and saying, right, I want to create this sort of shot, and therefore lining everything up along those lines. So saying, right, well, I want the person to be kicking the ball about here, and I want that to be in the background, and not being afraid, particularly if you're an amateur and you're working with other amateurs who will be happy to stop and help out and slow down and redo things, then you can create the sort of things you want, rather than, say, going along to a Saturday match and getting stuff and coming home and thinking, oh, I didn't get anything like the sort of shots I wanted because they didn't do what I wanted. It's like, well, they're not going to, you know. Yeah. If you go and photograph a live event, people will do what they do, and you may get some absolutely outstanding pictures from it, but if you're able to control it in any way, you'll have a much higher chance of getting stuff that you think or other people think look outstanding.
Tom, is there anything else you want to plug?
I think off the top of my head, I mean, website and blog are the two main things, so... Yeah, I mean, that's tmphoto.co.uk and photosmudger.com.
Thanks, Tom. Great chatting.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
In Masterclass, we pick a topic in sports photography and we discuss it with our interviewee. So this month, Ryu, our topic is going to be off-camera flash or remote flash. And to kick off this Masterclass, let me ask you, you know, why do we use remote flash in sports photography? You know, why do you use it?
One aspect of remote flash or off-camera flash in sports photography is that you can kind of harness your inner creative side of things. Because of the fact that most sports photographers you'll see on any sporting event will have his flash guns on top of their camera, it only kind of goes in one direction. You can move the head left and right, up and down, but it's stuck there. So if you want to angle it, for instance, if you want to have the light come from bottom up, whilst you're actually shooting from top to bottom, you can't do that because if the light's stuck on top of your camera, it's not possible to do it. It's not physically there. So you take it off. And one of the reasons I do it is that I've actually seen a guy called David Black do his thing. I don't think he actually does that much sports photography now. But at least a couple of years ago, he was doing a lot of off-camera flash. And he also does kind of light painting thing as well. Anyway, he used it in a way that I've never seen it done before. And I basically copied his way of doing it. Kind of like added my twist to the whole thing because he, for instance, didn't darken a background as much as I do now. Because I make it quite pitch black and try to just get one person or one subject lit up in a rest totally completely dark. But it's kind of a way to differentiate your picture from the rest of the people that are out there doing the same thing. And if you've never tried it, it is something that you should probably try it out.
So you're really using it almost like trying to create a studio environment in a sporting arena where you can't control a lot of things.
Yes, it's exactly it. But at the same time, it's not very easy because there's a lot of things that could go wrong.
You don't walk around with an umbrella or a reflector or anything like that, do you?
I wish I can. No, you can't do it. I mean, they do kind of do something very similar to it when they have interviews on the pitch. When TV people come and do the interviews, they kind of set up these light things and do whatnot. But us sports photographers, we can't really setting anything up on the pitch. Maybe we can if you're probably... No, you probably can't. So the only thing you can do is you have to kind of know what the course of event is during a football match or during any sort of sporting event. And you know when the players are going to come out, where they're going to be. And you kind of have to be a step forward and do your shot then and hope for the best because you will have a lot of duds. And there's no retake, obviously. So you kind of have to live and die with how you set things up.
Do you ever have an assistant hold the flash?
No.
Because you don't have an assistant?
Yeah, I don't have an assistant. I've had one, but I made that girl cry, so I don't think I've actually had one since then. You can have an assistant, but I've never actually seen an assistant roaming around, at least in a football pitch. I've seen it done in other places, but definitely not on football. Yeah, because there's just not that much space, and I don't think they don't like assistants roaming around if you're a photographer, you know? So I guess you just have to kind of do everything on your own. Got flash on one hand and your camera on the other, and then you kind of have to figure out how to do it at the same time.
We're going to talk about the technical bits a little bit later, but there's another reason I think why people want to use remote flash in sports photography or use remote flash at all. Situation is in a lot of indoor stadiums, there's some pretty tricky lighting that's in these stadiums, and the general category of lights is called sodium lights, where it's not a constant light stream and it sort of varies every 60th of a second or some other frequency. And it becomes really difficult to actually shoot indoor when you have these lights because every exposure when you're shooting at high shutter speeds, the light balance is completely different from shot to shot. So you want to use remote flash to really be the dominant light source so you can actually balance it properly and get consistent lighting. So there's really, in my view, I think two general reasons why you want to use remote flash. One is to create the creative stuff that you were talking about, but secondly is actually to create a stable lighting environment so you can actually shoot the action.
Can you give us an example of when you've used off-camera flash in a sporting event?
You remember, I think in the last podcast, I mentioned that I had to take a whole bunch of portraits or headshots of a few hundred sports players. If I had just used the ambient lighting that was in the sporting hall, the white balance would have been really difficult to get consistent from shot to shot. So what I did was I actually set up a little mini studio in the corner of the stadium and used off-camera or remote flash to basically be the dominant light source. So I can have a consistent white balance for all of the shots inside a stadium. So even though most indoor stadiums, this light looks pretty good, the reality is when you're shooting at high shutter speeds, the white balance can go from literally very green to very blue to very yellow, all within a second of each other because of the way that the sodium lights actually work inside a stadium.
Because what really throws off, at least in football matches, is that the, I don't think it's LED or LCD advertisement boards that go around the pitch.
Yes.
And they throw off not just the white balance, the exposure as well.
Oh, yeah. They can be so bright, can't they?
If I'm shooting like ISO 1600, I just go for shutter speed 800 and then 2.8. I just leave it there. And I use a manual setting because I used to just use shutter priority, the S1. Because I can then choose whatever shutter speed I want. If I want to slow things down and make it a blur, I can do that just with one step. But now I don't do that anymore and I shoot everything manual because of the fact that if I had a shutter priority setting and if there's those moving LCD advertisement boards, it just throws off your exposure completely in different types of adverts. That's one reason that I would hope that they'll come up with a better lighting and also maybe a better advertisement board that only shows maybe one color. That would be very helpful.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, probably not.
So the other thing about remote flash, I just want to touch on another very important point, which is when can it be used? Obviously going to be different from sport to sport, but there are sports that you can use it during a match. So for example, there are many basketball stadiums and basketball tournaments where it's generally acceptable to set up remote flashes high up, you know, in the stands and have those triggered remotely. Obviously, there's a lot of extreme sports, skateboarding, snowboarding, whole bunch of stuff where they're not really team-based sports, but they are sports, and the skateboarders and the snowboarders are used to having flashes gone off to fill in shadows if you're shooting against the sun and so forth. And obviously at football matches, you can do pre and post-match and team photos and stuff like that. You can use off-camera flash. Can you think of any other situations of when it can be used and when it can't be used? Have you ever seen anybody told off for using flash anywhere?
So I have been told off, and that was when I was shooting figure skating in Paris for one of the Grand Prix. I wasn't told off by the marshals or the security guards. I was told off by the fellow photographers. You're not supposed to use any sort of flash whilst practicing, because there was a practice round the day before the competition. I went over there to shoot a couple of shots because certain positions you can't use during the competition itself. And I went there and I was using flash and they said, no, you can't use it. You can't use flash in judo during the competition. In most cases, it's usually, like Sid said, it's pre or post match that you can use flash.
I think that essence with all of this stuff is if you're unsure, go and find the media manager and say, can I use remote flash? And if they look at you strange, then just walk away and start using it.
But that's the best advice, because they will tell you if it's bad. They will tell you, and then you just say, I'm sorry. You know, you just stop what you're doing and that's it. They won't do anything to you. There's a problem if you keep on doing what you're doing, even after you're told you're not supposed to. Cardinal rule. In sports photography, when they tell you to stop, you stop. Don't do it again, because they will catch you and there'll be bigger consequences in the future.
Yeah, you get your accreditation pulled. That's the worst.
They'll take your name down and, yeah, call your parents and I'll come tell them to come over here.
So the last section in the masterclass is the really technical bits. You know, what do you need to actually shoot with remote flash? And I'll kick it off by just generally talking about flash systems for both Nikon and Canon. Both have really smart remote flash capabilities. On Nikon, the system is called CLS, Creative Lighting System, and on Canon, they call it ETTL. And basically, both of these systems allows the photographer to control a flash that's off camera with a control unit that sits on top of the camera. And that control unit is either a dedicated control unit or it is just another flash that's compatible with the CLS or ETTL for the Nikon and Canon respectively. Now, both of these systems rely on infrared pulses to control the flashes. So that basically limits its usefulness because unless the flashes can see the infrared pulses, the remote flash is not going to work properly. For most part, if you're in a studio or if you're in a place with a short distance with lots of areas for the light to bounce off, these systems work really, really well. But I know that Ryu, you use a radio transmitter that doesn't rely on just the infrared line of sight. It means that with radio triggers, you can have it for further distance, as well as you don't actually need to have reflective surfaces for the infrared to bounce around. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what system you use to control your remote flashes and why you selected it?
I have two SB800 that is strapped onto a grip that was made by Michael Bass for a price. And I also have a radio popper that is attached to the flash and two cords, two optical cables from the radio popper onto the SB800 where the infrared receptor thing is, because that's how it communicates with the radio popper. And then on my D3, I've got SU800 on, and on top of the SU800, I have the radio popper transmitter. So what happens is that I can use TTL, because if you just use SU800, there's a limit. Like Sid said, if there's a reflective surface, i.e. inside a stadium, if my SU800 is not in line with the SB800, it will not fire. I missed a lot of shots that way, and I thought the best way to do it is to have the radio combined with SU800 and SB800, and therefore it will shoot TTL. And the reason I'm doing this is that the situation on a football pitch or in a sporting event is ever-changing. There's nothing, it's constant. Unlike a studio shot, you cannot set everything up and say, okay, I'm going to have all these flash guns powered in a certain way with this much exposure and whatnot, because 2 seconds, half a second later, things will all change if you're on a pitch because people are moving out in and about. And you want the flash to do all the thinking and camera to do all the thinking and not you. And that's the reason why I've actually chosen Radio Popper to be paired up with SU800 and SB100. And therefore, I'll have less missed shots because they're doing all the thinking and not the stupid one, me, doing the thinking.
So tell me how you actually set up your Nikon camera. So do you set it up on manual? Do you set the speed? How do you actually configure a typical shot that you use?
It's P. I like using P because P is, I'm relying on the camera to do all the job for me. What I do is I've actually learned, David Black. His website, and I've realized how he was using his remote flash and how he had put orange gel on top of both SB800, and he underexposed it by at least a step. In my case, I've gone even further down, make it 2 or even 3 steps. And therefore, when you shoot, you will have the background that is completely black. And you then will have the subject lit up with your flash guns. And the other thing is that you've got the white balance. And Dave Black had it as less than 3,000, so it's quite cold. It's blue. So you'll have the bluish dark background with the subject, which is usually the players, lit up quite warmly because of the orange shell.
Very interesting. So you use exposure compensation to underexpose, right?
Yeah.
And on the SU800, do you then set the flash to overexpose?
No, it's just the same. So because I've actually tried it overexposing, on most occasions it comes out too exposed, if you know what I mean.
Right, so you don't compensate on your flash at all. You just basically tell the camera to underexpose everything, and the flash is just left as neutral.
Yeah, and then it's supposed to kind of figure out what the exposure should be at that moment.
For an overall underexposed look.
So the underexposed thing is done by the camera. You know, that's what I do.
We'll post a link. There's basically a couple of other remote trigger systems for the flashes. There's just a pure radio transmitters where it's not amplifying or boosting the CLS or ETTL of the Nikon and Canon, whereas these are just purely for triggering the flashes. These are the Pocket Wizard 2 and the Multimax Pocket Wizards. And there is another flavor of third-party radio-based triggers that is like the Radio Poppers, but it's also made by Pocket Wizard. It's called the Mini TT1 and the Flex TT5. We'll post links of these on our blog so you can go and do some research. Unfortunately, none of these systems are really cheap. Probably the easiest way for you to get started in experimenting with remote flash is if you've got a prosumer type camera that's in the Nikon or Canon systems, because the little pop-up flash that you have on top of these prosumer cameras can actually act as the master controller for a remote flash. So you don't actually need to buy any more equipment except just to buy a remote flash, and you can start experimenting with it. The irony is that all the pro-level cameras, the Canon 1Ds and the Nikon D3s, they don't have a flash on the camera at all. So you've actually got to buy either a second flash or a dedicated controller like the SU800 for the Nikon to actually experiment with this stuff. So most of our listeners, if you don't have pro level gear, you can actually get started a lot cheaper than if you're actually using the pro bodies.
So obviously you're using the SU800s, SU900s.
Don't use the commanders, because I use CLS only when I'm very, very close in. I still tend to use a combination of radio triggers and the SU4 built-in slaves, which I think are inspired, frankly. I think one thing that Nikon should be eternally commended for is the fact they have kept lots of old-school technology on board.
Just for our listeners,
of course, sorry.
For benefit, the Nikon CLS system is the built-in proprietary Nikon system, and that fires the flashes using optical connections rather than radio connections. So you need line of sight. That's the main problem with the Nikon flash system.
Well, it's the main problem with it with any optical triggering system, but yes, it's that's the drawback to it.
I do actually use the SU800, but I realize the limitations of it, and now I've actually have radio popper attached to the SU800, which triggers my off-camera flash.
Back to your gear, Tom. With your off-camera flash, are you using the old-style Pocket Wizards, the 2s and the Multimaxes, or are you using the newer Mini TTs?
I haven't switched to the new ones yet, because I've had mine for so long anyway that it's a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If I had £1,000 lying around, I would go and get the full set of whichever they are, what are they called again?
The Minis and the Flexes.
Thank you, the Flexes, yes, because I do think they're incredibly impressive. I have seen 1,001 forum posts that they're a little bit patchy at the moment and haven't quite reached fully robust performance levels, but in terms of what they are able to achieve and the other results I've seen, I mean, it would be fantastic, because whenever I do use CLS, I never use TTL because I don't use it for anything, but I do love the ability to be able to sit there. There's a race going on and runners are coming past me, and one of my flashes is 8 feet away, and I can simply tap a button and say -2/3 in that light, and it does it the next time I fire it.
You can remote control the power.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, which is fantastic. And of course, with, as you know, with the Flex and the Minis, you could do it over a much longer range and not need line of sight. I would love a set, but right now I don't have £1,000 knocking around, because of course you don't just need one, you need one for every head you're going to use.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I want to come back to your comment earlier about you like the SU4 mode on the Nikon flashes. That's actually a legacy mode where effectively each of the flash heads has a built-in optical slave. If it sees a flash going off, it's going to trigger that particular flash as well. Then, Tom, why do you love that mode so much?
I love it because it's simplistic and robust. I've been using off-camera flashes for 16, 17 years, and the first things I used were studio flashes, which forever and ever have had built-in optical slaves, just the same as the SU4 mode on the Nikon flash guns. So to me, it's a totally natural idea that I have a trigger on the camera, or I have a sync cable plugged into the camera, which triggers one light, and then everything else synchronizes off it. So for me, it's almost a natural extension of taking my studio outside. I find, obviously, it also has a much longer range than the CLS mode. It seems far more reliable in terms of all it needs to see is one pulse of light and pop, it fires. Because I do things in manual, I'm not worried about TTL and losing out the TTL, because it's not my concern.
For example, you just have one of your flashes triggered by
the Pocket Wizard,
and then you have a cluster of other flashes just in SU4 mode, and bam,
Nine times out of ten, that's exactly how I do it, for simple reasons of not wanting to complicate things and ending up with daisy chains of pocket wizards. I mean, I do own three pocket wizards so that I can do that if one of my flashes is tucked away somewhere where it can't get line of sight. But I've historically very rarely had the need to use more than two pocket wizards, one on the camera and one on the key light, and everything else slaves off that.
How did you set up that shot of the cross-country runners?
Most of the cross-country running stuff, or the race events that you see, is lit with three lights. There will be a key at the front, and then there will be basically use a sort of outline or backlights. But that will vary. I mean, there's one on the website of a guy who looks like he's really plodding and working his way uphill and really putting his back into it. What looks like the sunlight coming down the track he's on is just three flashes clustered together to make one big light. And I'm simply using that as a shaft of light. Most of the other shots can relatively easily be sort of reverse engineered in terms of where things are placed. But what I found adds much more interest to things is being able to use longer lenses if required and put myself in different places. And for that, I find a radio trigger in the SU4 mode is the only way, because if I'm on a 70-200 and I'm 30 feet away, CLS just isn't going to work because it just won't see the light pulses. But then other races, I mean, there's a load of guys covered in mud clambering through a camouflage net, and that's one from about eight men's health races I've covered. And because of the nature of the event, I don't need to use anything more than 24-70 because I can stand in the middle of the course if I want to and have people run over the top of me. So it's easier and quicker. And on those events, I use CLS because I can plonk the lights down 3 feet away if I need to. And of course, it's quicker because I can just change the powers, just tap, tap, tap on the back of the camera, and much easier to do.
Because the fact that off-camera flash isn't used that much in live events, I use it in football, but I've never seen anyone else use it because it's something right. That's not really done that often. For people just kind of starting out doing sports photography, tips you can use maybe with like one flash gun or like one off-camera flash, where they should put it, or maybe two, because if they have D700, D300, they got another flash on your camera, so without effectively two, well, not a very strong one, but...
But enough. Single best tip I would suggest is try and use it in coordination with the light that's already there. If you look at some of the stuff on my site, you'll see that there are three lights on the go, but one of them's the sun. It's a bright sunny day and the sun is perhaps directly behind the subject, and I'm using one or two lights to fill them in. So there's a nice dramatic backlight from the sun on the subject, but of course they haven't gone to shadow because I've used the flash to fill them in. The other really important tip, if you're just starting out using it, besides the fact that you need to be fit to carry it everywhere, is the fact that, as I've said about triathlons and marathons and things, it is well worth recceing the entire course beforehand to find bottlenecks. Because, of course, what you want to do is you want to channel people into an area where you can be sure they're going to be lit. Because, of course, flash guns are very powerful little things for what they are, but they're not going to reach 30 feet across a bit of land if you're at F5.6 or F8. So you need to find bits where people are going to have to vault over a fence or work their way through an obstacle or something, because then you can use the maximum amount of power you've got and you can be sure they'll be doing what you want. As we said before, some of the answer is in preparation and possibly running the entire route in advance. That's a
really interesting comment. Ryu, with your shots where you use off-camera when the players are coming out on the stadium, I know that your technique is you actually just hold your off-camera flash out with an outstretched hand. But have you thought about putting the light on the stand as they come out through the race and then come onto the field?
I could, but they will probably get very angry with me.
Yes.
This get very angry with you.
Everybody.
And officials and coaches and players. The reason I actually use it, if I put it in my hand, is that I can carry it with me. I mean, I could first put it somewhere where no one's going to notice, but then in most cases, like, that angle is probably not going to really help me either. I think there's more that I could probably do with off-camera flash in the future, but for now, having two in my hand, and then I'm using the SU-800 and the radio popper, it works well, but it really depends on the stadium that you go to. Sometimes if you've got a place where you can actually set, like manually, just like set the flash. But in other cases, if you want to bring a stand, I mean, that's an extra gear you have to carry. I think in terms of football, it's not a very easy thing to do. Maybe like an indoor sports like basketball, volleyball. I've seen stuff that's done with off-camera flash, but they use even bigger like monoblocks for those shots. And that's, I think, is a bit crazy, but you know.
The other perhaps vital tip, if you're going to start out doing this, is you need to consider which event it is. For example, I didn't attempt at all to use off-camera flash at the London Marathon last weekend. Because for obvious reasons, as Ryu pointed out, if I'd started plonking light stands down, they'd be smashed over in seconds. Plus the security would say, what the hell are you doing? The events I photograph, either I have got such a good relationship with the organisers that I'm allowed to do what I like, or the events are so small that there's no real issue. Or it's indoors, whereby, again, I've got much less of a problem. My own instincts and experience kick in when it's a large triathlon or something, and I think, right, this won't work. And obviously, a football pitch would be a perfect example. It's a large area. You can't be too certain about where people will be. You can't light the whole area very easily. So it's almost a non-starter in terms of setting light stands up and hoping that somebody will run into the right spot at the right time doing the right thing. I wouldn't say it would necessarily work in every occasion.
I wanted to share a story that I thought was a really good application of off-camera flash at a Formula One in Melbourne a couple of months ago. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was the MotoGP. World Superbikes. In the pits, they generally are dark and concrete and not a lot of light. And these guys were just carrying an off-camera flash just on the built-in plastic stand that the SBA 800s and 900s come with. And they just put it down on the floor inside the pit, pointing up to the ceiling, and then they just shot the bike or the whatever they wanted to shoot in there. Obviously, they can add a lot more light in the really dark pits. And when I saw it, I thought, hey, you know, it's just an obvious and simple use of off-camera flash that's really easy to do with the modern cameras that not even the pro levels, but the advanced amateur cameras can trigger CLS. So I just thought it was very clever and obvious use for off-camera flash that fitted into our podcast today.
More and more people probably should be using off-camera flash, because if you have it on top of your camera, they all basically look the same.
Indeed.
Any sort of professional matches, all these guys come along, they form a line, they all have exactly the same setup, and you'll just get exactly the same photos. But the other thing is that, obviously, the clients usually ask for exactly the same photos as everyone else. Creativity doesn't really score you that many points. But, like, if you're doing it in the amateur realm of things, there really is no limit as to what you can actually try and do. Having off-camera flash, like Sid said, plug it down somewhere that you can actually find it quite useful and use it that way. You're allowed to do that because usually you don't have that many restrictions. And I think in the professional realm of things, as you know, we've pointed out, there are a lot of restrictions and a lot of safety issues and things like that, because if you set up something and if the players knock it down and twist an ankle, and that might be a really bad thing to do.
Where public liability insurance comes in.
Yeah, yes. But I think you should try to push it as much as possible, because like Tom said, sometimes you get away with doing things, sometimes you don't. When they do let you get away with things, that's the time when you can probably try to be a bit more risk-taking. You have to think about what the consequences actually will be for doing it, but that's probably the only time you're going to be able to actually use off-camera flash to photograph a basketball event or something in a place where you're not supposed to be. You guys try trying out their off-camera flash for the first time, just try to use it as much as possible, because the only bad thing that can happen is that they'll try to tell you to not use it.
For our amateur photographers or our budding professional photographers that are doing, for example, team photos and stuff like that, I think that's a perfect place to experiment with off-camera flash. If you've just got a team of guys at training and you just say, hey, I just want to take some headshots and portraits, just line them all up, bring an umbrella out, and just shoot some headshots for the team. I mean, that's a great way to practice. And in fact, I think in the last podcast, I was telling you that I had to shoot 540 football players and do the headshots for an agency. And I just filed them through. It was all off-camera flash, set up a little photo booth almost. And rather than taking really boring passport-type photos, it's pretty easy to make a dramatic headshot when you're doing off-camera flash. And it's just about practicing and using it and having some fun.
You Win is part of the show where you, the listeners, participate in a monthly theme competition. The top three photos will be presented on our site, and the grand champion will be interviewed on the show. And this month, our grand champion is Simon Leonard from Australia, and our competition was blur, so it's motion blur. So Simon, can you tell us a bit more about how you started sports photography?
Yeah, I started sports photography 2008. I was shooting the volunteers for a large Indy V8 Supercars event on the Gold Coast here. So just the volunteers, the flag marshals, things like that. But it gave me the opportunity to get into working for these people. I was able to get full media access, so I was able to get into the media outlets, shooting stations, and photograph from there. That gave me a great taste of what it would be like to shoot sports photography. I was shooting with 350D at the time, and even at that stage, the 450D was out, so I was looking pretty puny compared to a lot of the pros that were out there, but I still loved the event, and I still volunteer for that now. Continued with that following year with a 50D, so up to my equipment, and then I've been shooting a bit of ANZ netball, a bit of basketball, Pan Pacific Masters games, getting into as much sports as I can.
Excellent, excellent.
So Simon, great photo. Clearly it's the netball with Sherelle.
It's not Sherelle.
Right.
Who is it? Who is this? Who is this?
McLeod.
Was that?
McLeod?
She was absolutely convinced it was this Cheryl girl. It's like, oh, this is the very famous netball girl in Australia. So you're wrong.
So who do you reckon it is?
I'm just trying to recall. Alyssa McLeod, I think it is.
Alyssa McLeod. Okay. There you go. So how did you do the shot where she was like dancing and it's all blurry?
They were doing their warm-ups at the time and I was looking for an opportunity to trial some of this motion blur stuff. I've never really tried that much other than when I'm shooting the cars and I want to get a bit of wheel spinning sort of motion in there or a bit of motion blur in the background. But in the time frame, I had Firebird's game and that was it. So I just dropped the ISO right down to 100 and about 15th or a 30th of a second and just tracked the girls while they were warming up. It almost looked like a dance in front of me. It was fantastic when this one turned out like that. Of all the ones I took, this was the only one I really had any hope for. But to be honest, I didn't expect to have any chance of winning whatsoever. It's a very difficult art.
Did you handhold your camera or was it on a monopod?
I handhold, yeah.
Looks like there's a bit of vertical motion as well, whether they were sort of going up or down or whether as you were trying to track them, you know, you were moving the camera up or down. But you get pretty interesting effects, don't you?
Yeah, there's just a little drag vertical and trying to keep that left movement as they're moving across the front of me. Yeah, it's an interesting exercise. As I said, I never really delved into this and certainly explored an artistic component to it that I hadn't considered before.
Go on, Ryu.
I think a lot of people found it very, very difficult this time because I've seen the photos that were up on Flickr. Because I think it's very easy to kind of do sideways motion from left to right. If people are like going running from left to right and blur the background by kind of panning your camera, it's very easy to just, you know, focus on the runner or whoever is the subject and the background will be blurry. And what I liked about your photo is sort of the fact that really you had the girl in the front very nicely in focus and then the rest is quite blurry. And I think it worked very, very well. So congratulations. I mean, you deserve to win. Absolutely.
Simon, you were saying earlier that you started off shooting motorsport. Have you gone back and done any blurred stuff with motorsport?
I'm hoping I will be accepted into the team again this year to shoot for the V8 Supercars volunteers again. If I get the opportunity, I'll be shooting a little bit there. There's also a local event that I'm hoping to shoot a little bit of street machines at Willowbank Raceway. So I'll definitely be practicing a little bit more of this stuff there and with future Firebirds games.
Are you a student right now? Or are you working? Or what are you doing?
I'm a nurse by trade. I've worked in nursing for over 10 years now. I work in currently the infection control specialty.
Okay.
So I'm very diverse from photography.
It kind of proves that like anybody with a camera will have a chance to take, you know, sports photography. You don't have to be a professional to be doing so.
Yeah, I certainly love the art, love the sports photography in particular because it's a real escape from my everyday. Every day in my work, you do something wrong, someone's got to die, so you sort of got to be careful in nursing. It's not the kind of place where you can too relax, but I don't relax. When I'm shooting, I'm in a zone. I'm sure you guys experience something similar when you're at the field. You're in this zone, and it's a really lovely place to be.
Yeah, it's a bit of a less riskier thing to do, I suppose, photography compared to nursing, but...
In some ways, it's probably more so when you're in those V8 supercar street circuits. You're sort of got a concrete wall between you and those cars, but they hit you hard enough, they're going to hurt.
Simon, for our listeners, would you like to tell them a little bit about camera gear you're currently using to do a lot of your sports photography?
I'm still using the 50D. When I started off, I had the 350D. I had a 28-80 and a 75-300 from an old film lens, so I'm using kit lenses. At the end of the last year, the 75-300 sadly died, and I'm now using a 55-200. I think it's the slowest lens Canon ever made, but it's what I've got because I can't afford anything else. So I've had to learn how to extract every drop out of every lens that I have and get the best quality I can from that. So I'm shooting very high ISOs and using Lightroom to try and clean them up a lot with ISO noise. But it's taught me a lot of patience. I select my shots. I don't burst a whole lot. I shoot raw because that gets me that ability to resurrect a little bit more detail where it's lost from the poor quality lenses. Even if you're not burst shooting, you're still coming back with hundreds of images. You've got to be patient with your your hardware on the computer, because it does take a fair while to process, especially when you do shoot raw.
It's really not the equipment that will take the sports photos. It really is a guy behind the equipment who does, and it does obviously help. I mean, it does obviously help to have a very big lens, so like 400 2.8 or any very fast lenses to do sports, because of the fact that if you don't, you have to really boost your ISO, and you get a lot of noise, like Simon said, and you have to do maybe shoot in raw to get as much detail as possible, because it's all covered noise. I'm sure there are people out there who've got much better equipment than you have, who are taking less interesting photos, you know what I mean? So hopefully in the future you'll be able to actually save up enough money to buy the camera of your choice and the lens of your choice.
Ryu will lend you his lenses, but they're Nikon, so they won't work on your camera.
Simon, the last thing I want to tell you is that, well, this has already been said, competition this month is emotion, and I wanted to ask you, like, how you would go about taking emotions in the racing thing, because I wanted to know. I'm sure it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, I probably would stick to a driver coming out of the car after you won, but or something like that. You get a fair bit of emotion there, or celebratory burnout or something like that. You might be able to get something, but I'd probably be more likely over the next month anyway, only to be exposed to the netball. So I'd be looking at there. We're actually coming into finals at the moment, and the girls are have done a great job, undefeated all season. So they're very excited about this game, and I'm very excited because I don't have to travel to the next city to photograph them. I can actually stay in my home city. They're playing here today, so this week. So I'll be able to shoot them. And the stadium down here has a rooftop, like a maintenance access. It makes for some amazing shots. You can shoot down into the hoop from above. You get some really good perspective shots from there. Cool. So I'm looking forward to that opportunity. Hopefully the security guys will let me up. I did it, if you can get my photo stream, I did some shots for the Australian Diamonds, and I used a borrowed 70-200 2.8 for that day. And, it was sweet to play with, because you can really select with those narrower depth of fields, really select and throw out the background a little bit more. And I really enjoyed that experience. I'd have to thank Scott Belsner from SB4 Photos for that. He's been a big inspiration for me in terms of my sports photography. If it's okay for me to thank a couple other guys.
Sure,
go ahead.
Charles Knight and David McGahey from the Pan Pacific Masters Games guys. They've been a real inspiration to me along the way too. And I have to thank you guys. There's not a lot out there for podcasts, and I'm a podcast junkie for sports shooters. So you guys have done a great job. Big pat on the back, and so if I can do anything to help this out, I'll be there.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you very much, Simon. You are not the first one, but the second winner of our beloved, wonderful competition. And well, I hope you do well in the next one as well, because you could be the two-time winner, because there's no two-time winner yet.
Excellent.
So, looking forward to trying. I'm hoping to get some good emotions at the finals, so it should be good.
Yeah, make someone cry.
Yeah, get sweat. Sweat is always good.
In Far Post, Near Post, we take questions from our listeners and try to answer them as eloquently as possible. And this month, we've got my friend Aravin Menon from my high school in Hong Kong, who lives in Connecticut. And he wants to know, is the Nikon SB400 flash that much better than the internal flash in a Nikon D5000, such that it would produce better results for indoor sports photography? And is it better to use the Nikon 18-55mm DXVR lens or the 55-200mm DXVR lens when trying to get fast-moving shots? And our resident expert, Sid Lowe.
Well, I've got a problem, because that's two questions. But that's okay. We'll answer Aravin's two questions. So the question about the flash, we checked out the specifications for the SB400 and the internal flash on D5000. And the main difference is that when you look at the power, the amount of light that the two flashes emit, the SB400 emits about twice as much light as the Nikon D5000 built-in flash. However, the main problem, though, is that even with the SB400, it's sort of the baby of the flashes that Nikon make, and it really doesn't send out that much light, even though it's twice as much. So the question really is, you know, which would be better for indoor sports photography? Well, given that we've actually just spent quite a bit of time talking about remote flashes, I'm not sure how you would actually use the flashes in indoor sports photography. So if it was basketball, if you were just shooting directly on camera with the flash mounted on top of the camera, it's not going to really have much reach unless the player is right in front of you. So for sports, I'm not really sure whether either flashes is going to be really that good.
I agree completely. You should probably save up some money and buy a bigger flash.
My general tip is if you're going to start playing around with using remote flashes, indoor sports photography, is have a good look at a website called Strobist. And Strobist actually has a number of really good recommendations for flashes that you can buy that are not necessarily have to be Nikon lenses for a Nikon body and ways of triggering those flashes. So rather than buying a new SB400, for example, I think Strobist recommends scour around sites like eBay and buying an older Vivitar lens flash, because the Vivitar flash is actually really high powered and is really good to experiment and play with for remote flashes. So there's a lot of information on the Strobist website, and we'll post a link to that as well. Now, the second part of the question, is it better to use an 18-55 or a 55-200 lens to get fast-moving shots? I presume that question is to get shots of fast-moving subjects. The challenge with any fast-moving subject is you need to freeze the action. So to freeze the action, you need a high shutter speed, and you usually need high ISO, so you can get the fast shutter speed with the lenses. Both the lenses you mentioned in your question, they're not very fast lenses. In other words, they don't have a very wide aperture. So you're going to have to use a combination of both high shutter speed and high ISO, and you're going to have to rely on the body that you're using to actually focus and track the subjects. So I would say either lens is the same for fast-moving subjects. It's really going to be dependent on the body that you've got it on and how good the autofocus is for tracking those subjects.
Excellent answers. So if you want any of your questions answered by our resident super smart guy, Sid, and the not-so-smart super sidekick me, please write them on our blogs or wherever, wherever you can actually find a space on our website, biglensfastsighter.com. We will answer them as many as possible. Thank you.
What's a podcast without any shopping tips? Ryu and I will tell you what we bought recently and tell you why you need to have it now or it's going straight to the bin. So Ryu, what's your gas this month?
I was going to say iPad 2 because I bought it and I'm loving it. You don't need it. It's one of those pure want thing and it does stuff, but it's nothing to do with sports photography, so I'm a bit reluctant to do it. So maybe in the future, if I find something to do with it, I would. I've bought a lens. It's the 16-35mm lens f4, which replaced my 17-35mm f2.8. Now, listening to that, you would think that the 70-35 is better than the 16-35 because of the fact that the f-stop is one step faster, you know? Well, wider, or whatever you want to call it. The problem is the 17-35 was built a long time ago, back in the days of film, and it's made for film. Pretty much all of Nikon lenses made throughout the history of the company can be used on all the DSLRs that are out right now. They don't really work well with it. Case in point, you take any lens and you put it on any of the prosumer stuff, so let's say it's D70 or D90, it's going to be 1.5 crop, which means that you're going to, you know, lose, well, if you're going to be shooting far away, it's a very good thing because it'll give you 1.5 times reach, but if you're shooting wide, it will give you less because you have to multiply 1.5 and it's nuts, it's less wider. What I realized with the 16-35, it takes much sharper pictures than the 70-35. I think it's actually quite close in terms of corner performances. But honestly, it takes much, much sharper pictures over probably f6, f8 compared to the 17-35. It's slightly lighter, it's slightly longer. Focusing speed, probably on par. But when you're talking about wide lenses, focusing speed doesn't really matter that much. but it does help to be a bit faster. I think it's also got some sort of vibration VR stuff on it. So if you've got the shakes, then it'll probably help you take less blurry pictures. But I highly recommend it. If you're on the fence about getting a wide-angle lens for a full-format camera, if you're going to be using, like you said, a prosumer camera that's only got the 1.5 crop, this might not be the lens for you, although there's not that many out there. This will be a very, very good lens to really get into wide-angle photos. 16-35mm f4 is a very, very good lens, so go out and buy it.
Wow, okay. That's a real ultra-wide, that 16 mil down at that end. I used to really shoot with ultra-wides too. I had that same lens as you, the 17-35. It's actually the only Nikon lens I've actually bought, used it, and got rid of it within 6 months. I didn't like it at all. I don't know, it was just felt old and clunky. In fact, it was my first lens and experience after switching over from Canon, and Canon had a 16-35 lens as well, and I really loved it on a Canon because it was actually a 1.3 crop. So you add a little bit, that was almost like a 20 mil lens in full frame, and I just found that the 16 on the Nikon really, or the 17 mil, too wide for what I was using it for. Well, listen, my guess this month is actually a lens as well, and I've got a very different lens rather than a specialist lens, which is what you've got in your guess of the month. Mine is a general purpose lens. It's the 28mm to 300mm zoom, and it's a variable aperture. I think it's 3.5 when it's on the wide end and 5.6 at 300mm. This was the lens that I used almost exclusively for 3 weeks. I didn't have any other lens on because I wasn't shooting sport. I was just shooting, you know, people, landscape, street, everything. And the 28-300 is a new lens. I think it's only been on Nikon's product list for about a year. And there's been a few other photographers like Moose Peterson and photographers that have really been excited about this lens because it's so sharp. So if you can only have one lens on your full frame body, go and check out this lens. It's not super expensive. I think it's in US dollars. It's around $1,000, but it is a fantastic travel lens, walk around lens, street photography lens. One lens if you were shooting, for example, a runway parade and you didn't have any space because everyone's jam-packed to one space and you can only have, you know, one body and one lens. It's really a do-everything jack-of-all-trades lens. Incredibly sharp and versatile. So we've got two lenses.
Do you think this lens is good for taking sports?
I do. I think that if you were just getting started in sports photography, this would be an excellent lens, provided the body had a good autofocus system. If you were on a DX body, though, you wouldn't go for this lens. And certainly on Nikon, they've had the 18-200mm lens for the DX or for the prosumer bodies, which is, in terms of comparable focal length, is exactly the same as the 28-300. The 18-200 on a DX is basically the same as this 28-300 on a full frame. So both are pretty good lenses to get started with for general sports photography if you've got one of the better bodies that's got good autofocus.
Well, then don't let your wife know that you're buying stuff, and hopefully you'll buy these lenses and make Nikon happier, I guess, no?
Yeah, that's right. So last month for me, I think it was battery charge. This month I've actually got a lens.
Great. And with that, we end our third episode of Big Lens Fast Shutter. Special thanks to Spencer Griffiths for our dynamic jingles, Boltzmann aka Arvin Batista for the candy-colored icons, and can't really do this without them. To check out their info as well as our information, please check out biglensfastshutter.com. And see you next month. Done. See? It's all done, though.